Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we have often on American Variety shows that relate to kind of the intersection between culture and history. Our show today is such a thing. My guest is a prominent attorney in West Palm Beach, Florida. He's also an author and an archaeologist and an historian. His name is Harvey Oyer III. He's a descendant of one of the oldest pioneer families in South Florida, whose name was the Pierces. Welcome, Harvey.
Thank you for having me, Court. It's good to be back again.
And Harvey's been on the show a couple of times before, talking about a couple of different things. He's written a series of books based on the childhood life and times of an ancestor of his, a man named Charles Pierce, who was one of the legendary barefoot mailmen and was later postmaster of a town along the coast in South Florida, Boynton Beach, for a long time, about 40 years. And Charlie Pierce, as a child, kept a journal, which is fodder for Harvey, his, I guess, great-great-grand-nephew. Is that right, Harvey?
That is correct. He was my great-grand-uncle.
I threw in one too many greats there, but he was counting. So, but Harvey's written, along with being a busy attorney, has found time to write three children's books in a series based on Charlie Pierce's childhood and actually based on the actual adventures that he had, which is pretty amazing. So the first one in the series was called The American Jungle, Adventures of Charlie Pierce. And the second one, called The Adventures of Charlie Pierce, The Last Egret, which was about the plume trade and adventures that young Charlie had and misadventures in that regard. And Harvey's new book is called The Adventures of Charlie Pierce, The Last Calusa. And so we'll find out what a Calusa is a little later. But Harvey, why don't you start by describing the connection of this whole series to your family a little more than what I just gave just a minute ago.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. My great-great-grandparents came to Southeast Florida from Chicago in 1872, and they were one of the first non-Native American families to settle in Southeast Florida, an area that today, of course, is populated by many people, in excess of 7 million. They arrived in 1872 with their 8-year-old son, Charlie, and later they would have another child who turned out to be my great-grandmother. Her name was Lily. And Lily and Charlie and their Seminole Indian friend, Tiger Bowleg, are the central characters of the book series. And the book series is similar to a Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer, but instead of late 19th century Mississippi River, it's late 19th century South Florida. And their real-life adventures were more interesting than a fiction that one could come up with. So I have the benefit of their stories and journals, and those journals form the basis of the book series, which is now one of the most popular children's book series in Florida, one of the most widely read.
So you call it a children's book, but in reading it, I mean, I can see it's a children's book, but it's not aimed at toddlers or anything of the sort. It's written from the standpoint of Charlie Pierce, who's a teenager in the book, and or maybe he's only 12 or so, but he's an intelligent, inquisitive, you know, observant, disciplined child, you know, who, I don't mean disciplined in that sense, but he's mentally disciplined. He thinks well in an organized way. And so the narrator is like a young man, really. And so I think it appeals to, you know, to teenagers and on up, probably to adults, wouldn't you say?
That is true. I have a lot of adult readers. It's not at all a picture book for children, but it is officially classified as children's literature. They're teenagers, but they struggle with real-life moral dilemmas and decisions, and so it has its appeal to the age group that's reading it, but it also has an appeal to an adult audience because it follows these kids through sort of a prehistoric Florida or early historic Florida, and along the way the reader learns all of the place names of the cities and counties and rivers and the flora and fauna and the unique history of not only Florida but really has national and international consequences, as we discovered in the last book, The Last Egret, the plume trade having an environmental impact that was seen globally. And this book, too, The Last Calusa, has very powerful overarching human nature impacts that really go far beyond the borders of Florida.
Yeah, so these kids in the book, their homestead is already on the edge of a jungle, basically, you know, because Florida was kind of the last frontier of the U.S. in the late 1800s. And, you know, it wasn't, California was already settled. I mean, you know, the gold rush was in the 40s and all this. So, you know, 40 and 50 years later, South Florida was still a wild place. And these kids venture out into the Everglades. And in some cases, they're the first, you know, sort of white people who've ever been there. And the book focuses on an expedition by Charlie Pierce and his valiant gang of kids and friends that you described, and some other people too. Why don't you just kind of give us the Cliff Notes version of the plot of the book?
Sure, I will, and I don't want to completely give it away, but my family was living on our family homestead, which was an island in what is today Palm Beach County, which didn't exist at that time. And a Yale University biologist, Dr. Livingston, came to our home. It was uncommon to have visitors at that time. We were very remote. There was no road or railroad or intercoastal waterway connecting us to the rest of the world. And he brought with him his graduate assistant, and they were in search of orchids. And as you probably know, in the late 19th century, orchid collecting hit its zenith. And that is when Queen Victoria had Kew Gardens built, and the great orchid collections of the world started to grow. And to grow them and identify new species, orchid collectors like Dr. Livingston, the Yale botanist, they were scouring the earth, including Florida, where there are many varieties of orchids. And they hired Charlie, who's a teenager, to guide them deep into what was then known as Peihaiʻoki, which was the Seminole or Miccosukee word meaning grassy water. Today we know it as the Everglades. And they were in search of orchids, or at least purportedly were. And so Charlie was hired at the very princely sum of $5 a day to be a guide. And he took his childhood friend Tiger Bowlegs, the Seminole Indian, which is helpful because Tiger was an even better guide through Peihaiʻoki. And much to Charlie's chagrin, his little sister, Lily, negotiated her way onto the trip. She was the more adventuresome of the group and very much a tomboy and always wanted to be a part of the action. She wanted to go. And surprisingly, the parents, Mama and Papa, allowed her to go because she used as her angle that what better education could I get than being on an expedition for several weeks with a prominent Yale University professor. So she negotiated her way on the trip, and they sailed south down around the bottom of Florida to the Cape Sable area, an area that's today Everglades National Park, and they went in search of orchids. And they found them, but along the way, the kids grew suspicious of Dr. Livingston's reason for being on the trip, because his behaviors were not indicative of someone searching for orchids. And what they eventually concluded and questioned him is, was he searching for treasure? As you know, Florida today and certainly back then was well known for having Spanish treasure. That's why this area where I live is called the Treasure Coast and the Gold Coast. Mm. Many shipwrecks over many centuries and a lot of trading of that treasure with the Native Americans resulted in legends of fortunes of buried treasure. And they concluded this because Livingston had old Spanish maps and a sextant and a compass and appeared to be looking for everything except orchids. And he kept wandering off from the orchid hunting. Well, eventually the kids confronted him, and in the middle of the night he took off and took all of their gear, all of their food, and left them literally to die in the Everglades. They had no choice but to go after him, and along the way they made a very unique discovery. They discovered a very ancient Indian who is not a Seminole, someone that even the Seminole did not recognize by his markings and his behavior. And he was the last living Calusa Indian. The kids had no idea what a Calusa Indian was. And this Calusa, being able to speak some Spanish, could speak to the graduate assistant who spoke Spanish and explain to the kids who the Calusa were. And it was a great teaching moment opportunity in the book to teach the readers who the Calusa were, because almost no child or adult in Florida has any idea what a Calusa was. but the Colusa were perhaps the longest living culture in Florida's history. And we're not sure how long it was, but it was measured in centuries and millennia rather than decades. And they dominated the southern half of the peninsula of Florida for a long period of time. They were the functional equivalent of what the Aztecs or the Inca or the Maya would have been to the Latin world.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, they didn't leave any language behind, a written language. They didn't leave pyramids or large lithic structures that stick out in the landscape. And so they've been lost, and they died out. And they were backfilled by European colonizers and Seminole Indians, and they've been lost to history. But their culture was truly a sophisticated one. They dug hundreds of miles of canals by hand to navigate across the state of Florida rather than around the state of Florida. They had a sophisticated political structure with a number of villages that paid tribute to one leader who was based on the west coast of Florida. They were a very fierce people. When the Europeans arrived, beginning in the 16th century, they resisted them strongly for a long time. There were no missions built, not what you saw with the North Florida, Georgia, Carolina Native American tribes, where there was an assimilation. It didn't occur with the Colusa. So it was quite a neat opportunity for the kids to meet this last living Colusa. They couldn't estimate his age, but he looked to be well over 100, and he lived in the middle of what is today known as the Florida Everglades, and he taught them about the culture. He had been apparently watching them as they traveled through the Everglades, and he saw that Livingston had abandoned them. And the kids, still assuming it was for gold treasure, followed the Colusa Indian deeper and deeper into the Everglades and discovered that Dr. Livingston was not, in fact, after buried treasure. He was in search of the fabled Fountain of Youth that's associated with Juan Ponce de Leon, the man who named Florida in the year 1513.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't give away the rest of the book, but it does involve finding the Fountain of Youth and the lessons that are learned and the metaphor that a Fountain of Youth stands for with respect to Mother Nature, Mother Earth, and pretty powerful lessons for the kids that they would carry with them for the remainder of their lives. So that's the premise of the book. And it's very appropriate because Florida is celebrating its quincentennial, which is the 500th anniversary of Ponce de Leon landing in and naming Florida. Of course, Ponce de Leon didn't know he was going to find Florida. He was the Spanish governor of Puerto Rico who sailed west to find the island of Bimini. But instead, he landed in Florida, which probably was Bimini, as a matter of fact.
Hmm.
It was springtime in the year 1513. Florida was covered with flowers, and he named it La Florida, today Florida. And ironically, Ponce de Leon encountered the Colusa. They were not welcoming. They were very hostile. He retreated and came back 8 years later in the year 1521, and very stupidly went right back to the southwest coast of Florida to the Charlotte Harbor area, which was where the Colusa chief called a cacique lived. So that was their Washington, D.C., their seat of government. And again, he tried to engage the Colusa, and this time they shot Juan Ponce de Leon with an arrow. It did not kill him immediately. He was taken back to Havana, Cuba, to recuperate, but he did not. He died. So the Colusa people are responsible for killing the man who named Florida 500 years ago.
And I guess the Spanish got their revenge later. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Harvey Oyer, who's an attorney in West Palm Beach, but more to the purpose of our show, is the author of a series of books, that are really children's books, but they're aimed at teenagers and really adults. They're very, very easy reading. It's kind of, the narrator sort of reminds you of Tom Sawyer, you know, sort of an intelligent, clever, imaginative young man, really, and the adventures they get into in the Everglades. Harvey, let's talk for a minute more about the Calusas. How numerous were they, do we know, and what happened to them? They were there for 1,000 or more years, as you said, and then they died out suddenly after their encounter with the Europeans.
I don't know if there's a good estimate by archaeologists how many there were. If there is a good estimate, I'm not sure that that doesn't change every year, every decade, when they find more settlement sites. But they do have a good idea of when they died out. It was really within 2 centuries of European contact, and European contact, of course, started in 1513. Throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, there was colonization and settlement of Florida. And some of it was due to warfare. Most of it was due to the lack of immunity to the common colds and flus that the Europeans brought with them, which decimated all the pre-Columbian Native American tribes.
Sure.
There was also some slave trading. The Spanish did, as you know, enslave a lot of the Carib, Caribbean, and Native American people. And even the Seminoles, who later came to Florida, they were part of the Creek Confederacy in Georgia and Alabama. They and other Native American tribes were also slave raiders and traders, and the Calusa were victims of that. And it's largely believed that by the late 1700s, the last of the Calusa were gone. Now, there's no certainty with that, and there are Seminoles that claim that they have Calusa blood in them, that some of the Seminoles and Calusa intermarried, and that they can actually identify by looking at facial features and height of Seminoles and Miccosukees today which ones are descended from Calusa. Whether that is true or not, I do not know.
I would think that most Floridians think that the Seminoles were the Native American tribe of Florida, but in reality, they were kind of a latecomer and sort of a mixed race group, really. They weren't in Florida at all until, the 1700s or so. What were the Seminoles, really?
Early 1800s, that's absolutely correct. They are latecomers, and after the pre-Columbian Native American tribes that were here for in the thousands of years had died out, the Seminoles backfilled and became known as the Native American group in Florida. Of course, they still are today, but they were not the ones that the Spanish encountered on their arrival 5 centuries ago.
So what do you think gave rise to the Spanish notion of a fountain of youth, something so appealing that it would cause people like Juan Ponce de León to risk their lives and lose their lives over it? What started that, and was there some basis for it at all, do you know?
It's widely believed by, I think, almost all scholars that Ponce de León was never in search of a fountain of youth. He probably never heard of a fountain of youth. That is a legend that has grown up almost entirely after his death. Now, there are different ideas on how that came into being, but perhaps the most widely regarded one by academics is that a Spanish biographer, some 70 years after Juan Ponce de León's death, wrote a history of the New World, and in it he described this being the motive of Ponce de León's coming to Bimini or Florida. Why would he write that if it wasn't true? Well, at least one line of scholarly thought believes that this historian's family was at odds with Ponce de León's family, both noble Spanish families, and that in his writing, he was trying to discredit Ponce de León's family by suggesting that this nobleman would travel and risk his life and the lives of others and the Spanish crown's money for such a folly as a fountain of youth. And he stated that Ponce de León was an impotent, weak man, which is a very hurtful thing to say about a Spanish nobleman. And to state that he was impotent and searching for a fountain of youth was an insult that would insult the Ponce de León family forever. So it's believed that that is why it was written. And, of course, it's been repeated over and over again for another 4.5 centuries to the point that everyone today ties the two together. And if you travel to St. Augustine, the oldest city in North America. There's a statue of Ponce de Leon next to a Fountain of Youth. And if you watch the Pirates of the Caribbean movie with Johnny Depp a year or so ago, it was about Juan Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth. There's no historical or archaeological evidence at all that there ever was a Fountain of Youth, that Ponce de Leon was looking for one or found one. However, it's a great story. It's a great story for Florida. And the Fountain of Youth is maybe just a metaphor for the natural wonder that is Florida.
Well, that's interesting. It wouldn't be the first time that a petty personal squabble got mixed up with politics and eventually got elevated to history, right?
Not at all. I think that's commonplace, and our history books are rife with examples of that, and I think this is one of them. And Florida and its Fountain of Youth concept is actually what brought my family here. My family came from Chicago in the early 1870s because four family members had died of tuberculosis. And a fifth family member was diagnosed with TB and told that he would most certainly die if he stayed in Chicago, and that he would stand a chance of living if he came to Florida. Well, he came, and he brought his sister and brother-in-law, my great-great-grandparents, with him, and he did live into his 80s. So in that respect, Florida was a fountain of youth. It extended the life of a man who was almost certainly going to die if he stayed in a northern big city like Chicago. And that is what has caused generations of people to vacation and retire to Florida. So there really is a fountain of youth in a sense.
Well, you mentioned the statue of Ponce de Leon in St. Augustine, and for all of my life, pretty much, it was taken as a given that Ponce de Leon landed first set foot in Florida around St. Augustine, but there's been other speculation, and in fact, that's pretty much been disproven, I think. What do you know about that?
Well, I think the fact is we'll never know with any certainty, but most of the scholarly world does not believe that he landed in St. Augustine, as you've stated. Most of the scholarly world believes that his first steps on this continent were in the Cape Canaveral to Melbourne area, and that he then sailed further south and sailed into the Jupiter Inlet in what is my county, Palm Beach County, and eventually made his way around to the southwest coast of Florida to the Fort Myers, Sanibel Island, Charlotte Harbor area, which is where he encountered the Colusa. And he no doubt would have stopped in Biscayne Bay at current-day Miami. It would have been too tempting not to, a gigantic freshwater bay with the Miami River spilling into it. So I suspect he hugged the coastline of Florida and called into any harbor or port that his vessels could fit into. But St. Augustine was almost certainly not one of them.
The original Florida tourist on a cruise, right? I tell you, why don't we read, Harvey, if you would, a passage from your book to give folks a flavor of kind of the way it's written and how it sounds.
Sure, and I need to preface this with telling you the name of the Colusa Indian, very unusual name. His name was Papat Ucali. And so this is after the kids have met Papat Ucali, and they're still hot on Livingston's trail, maneuvering deeper and deeper into the Florida Everglades, but now with the Colusa Indian Papat Ucali as their guide. So I'm picking up on page 139 of the book. Up ahead, Papat Ucali had stopped poling forward, and his canoe was gliding along the narrow, twisting river, pulled as if by a light current. He looked back at me and held his hand out for me to stop paddling. I gratefully put my pole down and felt a slight current grab our canoe and pull us forward beneath the magnificent canopy of vegetation. Overhead, creepers and vines hung down from the trees, reaching for us like hairy and thick fingers. Before long, the thick vines were close enough overhead that I could almost grab them. And that's exactly what Papat Ucali did. Silently, without warning, he reached up and grabbed a thick vine, then turned for me and motioned for me to do the same. I got up on the canoe platform, praying I wouldn't fall headlong into the water as the boat rocked beneath me. I swiped at passing vines until finally I got a hold of one. The gentle current tugged at us and almost pulled me over. I was about to complain about hanging on these vines like a monkey when I heard Lily say, "Oh my, look, Tiger, look." On the left bank, there rose a short wall of white coral rock that glistened with copper-colored veins and pink hues like a conch shell. Trees grew up and over the rock, their roots lacing over its face like long tentacles, gripping it firmly to the shore. Midway down the rock, there was a perfect hole, and a natural spout had formed to allow a little stream of clear water to gush into the canal. I had seen freshwater springs before, especially in the center of the state when I traveled with Papa, but I had never seen a spring come from the middle of a rock. I had the feeling that if I touched the water, it would be shockingly cold. Papadu Kali was staring at the stream too, his lips moving as if in a silent prayer. "Hey," I called to him, my voice too loud for the hushed waterway, "why are we stopped here?" Just then there was a muffled shout from the island, somewhere deep in the thick trees beyond the spring. "So I'll stop here, Court, but this is the kids finding the Fountain of Youth and apparently stumbling upon the devious Dr. Livingston, who's already found the Fountain of Youth and is trying to get away with canteens full of water."
So you can tell that it's a well-written book, and it's not written, as we said at the beginning, at the level of, you know, reading a toddler to sleep or whatever. It's basically written for teenagers and young adults and adults of all ages, I would say. It's interesting, and it's clearly written and very visual. You know, you get a very vivid sense of what these kids are surrounded by as they're trekking through primeval Florida. Well, let me give you the website for the book and for the whole series, really. There are three of these books so far. And I suspect Harvey might have one or two others up his sleeve. The website is www.theadventuresofcharliepierce.com, and the last name is spelled P-I-E-R-C-E. So theadventuresofcharliepierce.com, and of course all closed up. And it's available through Amazon and Borders, and on Facebook, you've got a page, facebook.com/CharliePierceBooks, right?
Yes, I do, and actually there's quite a few hundred Charlie Pierce followers now. Charlie has become a bit of a cult figure amongst kids in Florida. In fact, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission runs outdoor youth conservation camps. They have for some decades, and they've renamed that program the Charlie Pierce Experience because so many Florida children identify with Charlie Pierce. And it's now mandatory reading in the largest school districts in Florida: Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, Martin, Monroe. So combined with the private schools, there are about 70,000 fourth graders a year, every year, that mandatorily read about Charlie, Lily, and Tiger. And they think they're just reading a cool story about kids that they can identify with. But what they're really learning is all of Florida's history, geography, flora, fauna, all the things we want our children to learn, but they don't want to learn it if it comes out of a textbook. But we have duped them into learning it by giving them a cool story to read.
Well, that sounds great, Harvey. I appreciate the reading, and I think it's a great educational opportunity for kids to go to that website and look around. It's a fun-looking website. It's very well designed, and I hope you'll write more of them. I appreciate you being on with us on American Variety, talking about the adventures of Charlie Pierce. Harvey?
Thank you, Cord. I appreciate it, as always.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.